I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity, so we saved you some time to get right to the good stuff. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. As we continue to see the Scott administration make incremental changes to gatherings, work environments, and retail and service sector protocols, these spigot turns, as the governor is calling it, go hand in hand with a significantly beefed up testing and tracing program. Last week, the state announced that it would be ramping up testing to as many as 7,000 plus per week, and the tracing capacity is also ramping up. Now, tracing depends on positive cases, but state epidemiologist Patsy Kelso said the state would be prepared to conduct tracing on as many as 900 cases per week, which would be just about the same number of cases we've currently had confirmed over the trajectory of the entire pandemic in Vermont. Today on the show, we're going to talk more about testing and tracing, how the state came up with those numbers, and how they're sourcing and funding the testing and personnel. We're also going to tackle questions about outpatient elective procedures, which are now going to be opened up and allowed again in Vermont. What does that mean? Who does it apply to? And what are the significant safety protocols that must be in place continually for procedures to be able to happen at doctors' offices, hospitals, and elsewhere? State epidemiologist Patsy Kelso is with us today for this conversation. Nice to have you back on the program. Thank you, Patsy.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined again by Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan. Tracy Dolan, thank you for being with us again.
Hi, Jane. Great to be here.
So we want to talk first about testing and tracing, because this is a big program that the state has started to beef up. And as I said, it goes hand in hand with opening. The idea being that if you're opening certain sectors of the economy, certain jobs, certain areas for people increasingly to be able to gather in very small numbers, that you have to also have the ability to test and trace in order to keep infections to a minimum. So, Tracy Dolan, can you talk a little bit first about the testing capacity? How did the state get enough tests, and how do you make sure that you continue to have enough tests to do up to 7,000 a week?
Sure. And so there's been a variety of people in the state at the leadership level, including our lab director, our commissioner, and then, of course, the governor and his cabinet, that have been working hard to secure testing supplies. We've done that both through the federal government and through private vendors. At one point early on, Vice President Pence also assisted us when we were in a low supply state. But now we do have a fairly good supply line from vendors. And so we've been ordering the tests and all of the supplies that go along with testing. And we feel like we're in a good place, and it appears that we will have a steady supply to be able to support ourselves. So that's at the public health lab. And then, of course, UVM has geared up to be a wonderful partner in this as well. And they have a couple of labs, in addition to their own lab, a couple of labs also that they're using. And so together we have the supplies and the laboratory capacity to be able to ramp up as needed. In addition, there are a couple of small labs in Vermont. Rutland, for example, is doing some of their own testing as well. So we feel like we have good capacity.
Right, because it's not, it's sort of twofold. You have to have all of the supplies, and you have to have a place that can actually do the tests.
That's right. And we have both. We have a good supply chain, and we have plenty of capacity to actually do the tests, both within the state and outside of the state, in a couple of labs as needed.
There's a negative connotation to the word stockpiling, and I don't mean it that way, but is the state stockpiling tests now so that you can continue to have enough should you need more, and as we open up more quickly?
Yeah, I wouldn't use the word stockpiling. I think we have an adequate number for our projection moving forward, and we're certainly keeping enough of a supply that we have a buffer, and then we're continuing to order in. Of course, there's no guarantee, but right now we feel good about the supply we have and good about the continuation of that supply chain.
Patsy Kelso, in today's press briefing, Human Services Secretary Mike Smith said his goal would be to test everyone in the state. And I would add, you'd probably have to test people frequently. So it's not everybody gets a test and they're done. But you know, if he had his druthers, it sounds like he'd be saying, let's test everybody in the state frequently. There is currently, as I understand it, no plan to test everyone in the state, and certainly not to continue testing everyone in the state frequently. So why is the goal 7,000 tests per week, and how did you reach it?
Well, we really want to be testing more people than we have been so we can get a more accurate picture of the burden of COVID-19 in Vermont. We know that people can be in their incubation period before they develop symptoms and be able to spread this virus. And we also know that some people have very mild symptoms or even no symptoms, and they also may be able to spread it. So the only way we'll get a really good handle on what's going on in our communities is if we do more testing.
So then why 7,000? Why not 320,000?
Yeah, good question. There are some studies that show that you need to test about 150 people per 100,000 in your total population in order to have what is considered enough testing. And so when we did that math, it comes out to just about 1,000 a day or 7,000 a week.
Ah, so, I mean, this is a bad comparison, but it's sort of like doing a survey. You have to have a representative sample of the population, and essentially that's what you need for testing as well?
Yeah, you really have to be capturing enough of the population to say that you have a robust picture of what's going on. And right now, we're still focused on some very specific groups, mm-hmm. but those groups include anyone with even mild symptoms. So the testing is opened up pretty broad, and we want Vermont providers and Vermonters to be thinking about ordering these tests and seeking healthcare or seeking a test with even the mildest of symptoms.
We got a note about testing from Nicole, who says, why are we not following the new CDC guidance and testing people who are asymptomatic? We will fail in opening up our economy if our testing is too conservative. The excuse that the supply isn't there doesn't work anymore. Demand will dictate supply. We need to test much more than the state is willing to allow. Deputy Commissioner Tracy Dolan, I mean, the state is testing some asymptomatic people in specific groups that Patsy Kelso just sort of alluded to. For example, all employees in the Department of Corrections, as I understand it, are being tested. But Nicole is saying, you know, as we open up more, why aren't more asymptomatic people going to be tested?
Well, you know, we're actually following CDC guidelines as well. CDC has highlighted that where we particularly want to look, and CDC has done some studies in long-term care facilities, we're seeing there that there are a lot of people in long-term care facilities where there has been an infection who are asymptomatic, and then when they go back, it appears that it has spread there. So we're looking at our more vulnerable populations. And again, this is about what we can actually feasibly do. I mean, we can't in one moment hit all the asymptomatic people. So we are prioritizing the higher risk populations like the elderly, populations like corrections. Those are two that are called out in CDC guidelines. So I think that we really do want to move toward testing more asymptomatics once we also continue to move forward on those who have mild symptoms as well. So we're doing things along parallel paths. We're continuing to test some people with symptoms, but we are also moving to asymptomatic and prioritizing right now those where we think the spread might be quickest and the morbidity and mortality could be most severe.
Is it essentially a rhetorical flourish for AHS Secretary Mike Smith to say, I wish everybody could be tested, I'd like to get to that point? Because it doesn't sound like even in the state's planning, you know, as we move forward, even up to and including a time when there's a vaccine, that we'd ever be in a place where everybody in this state or everybody in the country is getting tested at regular intervals. That doesn't seem to be something the state is trying to get to the point of.
I think you mentioned earlier, and Patsy did too, the idea that if you test enough people, it really does give you a snapshot of the state. And so when Secretary Smith says we can test everybody, we may get to the point where we test enough people that it really does give us a good sense of the state. And while that's not everybody, it will give us enough information to say, on average, this is what we think is happening in our state. Therefore, these are the next steps that we can take.
That makes sense, clearly, from a health department and population health perspective. But if you're somebody who's saying, wait a minute, you know, my mom is 85. I want to be able to go visit her. But, you know, could I get tested every other week or so that I know that I'm not infecting her, or that my 7-year-old child who may never show symptoms isn't infecting my 85-year-old grandmother who is going to be caring for him because child cares are closed? You know, like everybody has their own personal stake in this, too.
Yes. Yeah, it may not be feasible that we test everyone, particularly on any kind of regular basis. I mean, realistically, but we will certainly test more and our numbers will go up. It's hard to say to what extent that will continue.
Let's go to Mort, who's calling in from Charlotte. Hi, Mort. Go right ahead.
Hi, this is Mort, and I have a question about the specific characteristics of these tests, the diagnostic tests, and I'll own up to having some background on the subject. I'm curious because I haven't been able to figure it out. What is the sensitivity of the test? That is the proportion of people who actually have the disease for whom the test will be positive. And the specificity of the test, that is the proportion of people who don't have the disease for whom the test will be negative. My understanding is that, and this relates to a previous caller's question about testing asymptomatic people, if the prevalence of the disease in the population you're testing is really low, then you get to a point where the majority of positive tests are false positives. So, any information on that, Dr. Kelso?
Yeah, I don't have the data in front of me. And as you probably know, there are lots of different platforms, even in Vermont, that we're using. There are different technologies and pieces of equipment that are being used to test these swabs. And they all have probably a bit different sensitivity and specificity. But the data I have seen suggests that the sensitivity and specificity for pretty much all the tests that we're accessing in Vermont is around 95%. So they're pretty good tests. You know, obviously you'd want them both to be 100% sensitive and specific. And that's often not achievable. So they're pretty good tests. But as you correctly pointed out, the predictive value of a positive test result is impacted by how many people truly have what you're testing for. And that can give misleading results if very few people have it, because with a test that's not 100% perfect all the time, if you test a ton of people who don't have it, you are going to just by chance get some positives because it's not 100% perfect test, and those may be false positives. So very relevant questions. We think the tests that we're using are a very good test, but they can be impacted by the people we're testing.
On the tracing front, Patsy Kelso, you said last week the state is prepared to trace 300 to 900 cases per week. How did you reach those numbers?
We have, over the last few months, been ramping up many of our different EPI teams who are responding to this outbreak. And one of those teams is the case follow-up team. And we've currently got about 50 people trained up and working on that team. And those are people from our regular infectious disease EPI program, as well as people from other health department programs who we've pulled in and trained up to do this work. So right now we've got capacity based on our calculations, figuring each staff person could conduct two full contact tracing protocols per day. That means two new cases, interviewing the case to find out who their contacts are, and then following up to interview each of those contacts. We can do, each person can do about two a day. So when we calculate out with people working, 5 days a week with 2 days off, we think we have the number of people right now who could do about 500 new cases a week.
So that's the capacity, but not the expectation?
That's the capacity. I certainly hope we don't get to the point where we have 500 new cases a week. But as we ramp up testing and as we open up the economy with Restart Vermont efforts, we do expect that we'll start to see more cases positive each day or each week than we have been for the last couple of weeks, just because there's more social interaction happening at workplaces, for example.
Tracy Dolan, though, if we ever got to the point where we were seeing 500 new cases per week, wouldn't that be an absolute crisis for the state, given that we just hit 900 cases total? Confirmed cases, I'll say.
Yeah, I think if we started to see significant rise,
we would reassess and we would look and see if the interventions that we have in place are sticking, if people are complying, and we would rethink our strategy. So I think that if we were seeing cases at that level, we may shift. However, it's good for us to have the capacity in case we get to that point. Obviously, we may do something significant before we ever got to that point. And so again, this is about our highest capacity. But obviously, if we see cases spike versus rise, we may stop and reassess and possibly put in some more stringent conditions again.
So, you know, when you say this, it's good to have that capacity, you know, sure, in theory, it's great to have that capacity if you're not putting people in place to provide capacity for something that is unlikely to happen at the expense of having resources in some other area. So are the people who would be doing the tracing not sort of stealing capacity from another healthcare sector or another resource or another anything else? They're just sort of on standby?
Yes, here in the health department, we're trying to ramp up primarily in the health department. These are people who are trained in public health. And this is really one of our highest priorities in public health. I mean, this is our highest priority right now. So sure, they have other work. And for some of them, they're on standby because we don't need them right now. But again, this is our highest priority. And if we end up pulling too many people and we're losing some of our other essential services, we will adjust as needed.
And let's go to Bill, who's with us from Morrisville. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I'll try to make this as succinct as I can. I had a mild case, contacted my doctor by phone, but did not need to be hospitalized or tested as a result of being hospitalized. I've recovered now 3 weeks and am seeking the appropriate testing so that I can, A, establish any immunity I may have, B, but more importantly, donate plasma, and C, eventually may need to have to show that so that I can work in certain sectors of my job life. But I think it's the first two that are most important. My doctor does not know how to access that test. The Red Cross seems to be only allowing testing for plasma donors who have had a hospital test done and since recovered. Where can I go? What can I do to seek a serological test at this point?
Bill, thanks for the call, and I'm glad you're feeling better. Tracy Dolan, what should Bill do?
Sure. I'll give a first answer. Maybe then I'll hand over to Dr. Kelso. So right now in Vermont, we're not recommending retesting after someone has been deemed positive. CDC has two ways to think about determining whether or not you're ready to return to work. For example, there's a test-based strategy where you get tested and you have two tests within 24 hours that are negative, and that sort of clears you. But the other that they're really promoting a lot now is the symptom-based return. And that's where you look at symptoms, you look how long you've been symptom-free, and there's a certain number of days, I believe it's 10 in total. And then at that point, you can move toward returning to work, obviously with all the correct provisions like wearing masks and social distancing. And so that's what we're promoting now for any of the staff or others that we are working with. And so I'm going to hand off to Patsy if she has other thoughts about serological testing.
Yeah, everything Commissioner Dolan said is correct. We are largely supporting the non-test-based return-to-work strategy, and I'm not aware of any Vermont employers who are requiring a test to be sort of cleared to go back to work, and the health department does not support that approach at this time. The serologic testing is a bit different. Serologic testing is a blood test. It's not a nose swab. They take blood and then they look to see whether someone has antibodies that are specific to this coronavirus. And we had a serologic testing work group with clinical and laboratory leaders, as well as public health professionals. And the recommendations from that working group were discussed by Dr. Levine at one of the governor's press conferences. The group determined that the tests available at the time just aren't good enough. They look at different types of antibodies. There might be some cross-reactivity with antibodies to this coronavirus and antibodies to other coronaviruses. So they're not specific enough. And we also just don't know yet what those antibody levels mean. We don't know that it means that someone is immune. So we don't know if having those antibodies protects you against getting infected again, or if it protects you from being able to spread it to other people if you get infected again. So maybe you won't be very sick or have any symptoms, but you might still be able to infect other people. So there's just not enough that we know yet about how to use those tests to really think they'd be an effective strategy in Vermont. The plasma donation is another separate issue. To my knowledge, there are no projects ongoing in Vermont at the time for plasma donation, although the Red Cross may have some programs, and we'd have to speak to them to find out what the requirements are.
But at this point, in terms of being, you know, Bill mentioned three areas that he has questions about, but one of them was plasma donation, and it doesn't sound like, not that that's not a priority, but that the serological testing has not really kept pace with the ability to sort of back test people who may have had the illness who now want to donate plasma, at least at this point.
Right. For it, the serologic tests certainly are not appropriate to use for decisions about whether someone can return to work or be around a vulnerable person. The serologic tests for plasma donation, I honestly don't know what's involved with that and what is being done around that. It's not something the health department is engaged with.
Got it. Deputy Commissioner Dolan, you mentioned that new CDC guidance suggests that people may still be testing positive when it sounds like they're not probably infectious. And so the guidance is to have a certain number of days symptom free, and then you may be able to return to work. But people who have had various coronaviruses that are accompanied by a cough will know, including COVID-19, that sometimes a cough can last 4 weeks, 6 weeks. How do you determine when you're symptom free? Is it just a fever? Is it you have to have no cough at all, no tickle in your throat? I mean, there's a lot of subjectivity in determining when you're symptom free in some ways.
There is. I believe the language says improved symptoms and no fever, but I'd have to check that. It's not in front of me. And so there is some subjectivity, and it might make sense that if you have a lingering cough, again, because we know that COVID-19 is primarily passed through respiratory droplets, then a cough might be a symptom that would not be advisable to go back to work with.
Patsy Galso, can you talk a little bit about the technology the state of Vermont is using when it comes to contact tracing? We got a question from Samantha who says, how will contact tracing work without reliable internet and cell phone access? And I understand there is an app that the state health department is using in connection with contact tracing. So can you address that?
There are a number of really cool apps out there, and they work in different ways. But they allow people to enroll and choose the way that they would like to be contacted on a daily basis so that the health department can check in with them. And so that could be through a text message and a smartphone isn't even needed. It could be just any cell phone that can receive a text message or an email or even a phone call if people prefer that, or just have a landline. So there are different options, and people can choose how they want to be reached through the app.
I've been hearing reports about cell phone services, providers being able to aggregate data and not use people's specific information. But for example, if you were in a grocery store at a certain time when somebody was exposed, you may be able to be contacted. When somebody was, who's later tested positive, you may be able to be contacted. Is this the kind of app that you're talking about? And does the state basically have to give approval for any kind of app like that for a Vermonter to be contacted?
That's not the type of app that we're looking to use. So that would be a location or proximity tracker type of app. And we're not proposing to use one of those at this time. In order for that type of technology to be effective, you really need 60% of the whole population or greater to be using that app. So to have a smartphone or an Apple Watch or whatever the technology is. So we're not proposing to use that. We're using a more basic system that basically lets us reach people every day to check in, whether they are a confirmed case, and we'd be checking in to see how they're doing. Are their symptoms improving? Have they recovered? Are they getting sicker? And maybe should they go to the hospital? That would be the daily check-in for a case. And then for a contact of a case, we'd also check in daily to see whether they were developing any symptoms that could be COVID-19. And if they did, you know, the app could recommend that they call their healthcare provider, or we could, you know, reach out to them and encourage them to do that as well. So it's just a way to check in with people on a regular basis to see if they're recovering or if they're becoming ill.
But can the state prevent that kind of location-based service provider from contacting Vermonters?
That's a good question. We'd have to check with the Agency of Digital Services, but the Vermont state government is not planning to use any of those types of apps.
Let's go to Vic with us from Heartland. Hi, Vic. Go right ahead.
Hi. Hi. I was reading an article yesterday about saliva tests that Rutgers has developed. They're using in New Jersey and some other states. And I'm wondering, you know, there seem to be a lot of variation in the different tests on how accurate they are, false positives, false negatives. And there appears to be that somebody's going to do a rating system of all these tests, maybe the CDC. And I wonder when that's going to happen. And, you know, we need to do so much more testing that there are these tests that are quicker and that can be self-administered. And I wondered what our epidemiologists see on the horizon for that. Is that going to happen soon? You know, we're probably going to be need to be testing on and off at least for maybe a year.
Vic, thanks for the question. Let's put that to Patsy Kelso. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a lot of exciting new things happening. Things change almost every day with this virus. One of the things that's changed is we're moving towards a nasal swab test rather than the nasopharyngeal swab. Or NP swab. NP swabs are mostly how all the testing has been done in Vermont so far. And that's a pretty invasive test. It's a very long shaft of a Q-tip that needs to go very deep into your nose, and it's uncomfortable. And it also requires that the person administering that test wears personal protective equipment or PPE, because doing the test can make someone cough or gag, for example. So what we're moving towards is a nasal swab, which is just a swab in the front of the nose. It's much easier to administer, much more comfortable for the patient, and doesn't require the person administering the test to wear as much PPE. We are building the test kits now and likely rolling out that type of test even later this week, assuming our supplies come in. So that's going to be really helpful in getting us to have more people tested, because they'll be able to access testing at more places, perhaps even their primary care provider. The saliva test is still emerging. I don't know that it's in wide use yet. It's not as simple as it sounds, although it is a self-administered thing. But it's not as simple as just spitting into a cup. The lab leadership at the University of Vermont has done some research on that, and it requires that the saliva be collected, I think, first thing in the morning before you've had anything to eat or drink. And it requires a fairly large volume of saliva. But we'll continue to look into that. And as that becomes more accessible and as the platforms to run those types of tests become more available, we may roll that out too.
We've been talking about tracing and testing, but there's lots of other stuff to talk about as well, including the opening up of some elective procedures for Vermonters and questions that many of you have still been sending us about when it's appropriate to wear facial coverings like masks and how do you get them? So let's start with masks. Lynn in Montpelier says, I'd like information on the times masks, face masks should be used. On the Vermont Health Department website, it says if out in the woods or walking in a neighborhood, as long as you keep 6 feet away from others, a mask is not necessary. But in grocery stores or pharmacies, it is. Another area on the webpage says you should use a mask once you leave your home wherever you are. So, Tracy Dolan, can you help Lynn sort of parse the language and when you might need to wear a mask and when it's okay not to?
Sure. You should wear a mask when you're around other people. I think examples of grocery stores, pharmacies, anywhere people are congregating are good examples. We do want people out. It's beautiful in Vermont. We want people out walking and exercising. If you're in an area where you're not running into other people or you're far from other people, particularly outside, you don't need to wear a mask.
So what if you're in the woods and you don't know whether you're going to encounter other people or not, and the trails are sometimes narrow? Should you just be bringing your mask whenever you leave the house and
wearing it? I think that's
a
great idea. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Dr. Levine mentioned that. He said that even when he's out in his area, I think he lives in a fairly rural area, and he brings it along because there are other walkers. And if it's a narrow trail and you don't think it'll be easy to step away and give someone room, then bringing the mask along is a great idea. And in addition, you may be driving somewhere and need to stop in somewhere. I keep a mask in my car for me and my kids at all times. And if we do have to stop anywhere, then we've got one ready.
What about running, cycling, other forms of exercise, where, as we've talked about before on this program, there's a chance that 3 to 6 foot margin kind of needs to be extended, because if you're cycling through an area, you know, that's you may be going fast and you may be breathing, you know, onto people. Should people be wearing masks when they're exercising?
I think if you're exercising in a place where you think you will be running into other people, bring a mask and wear it. If you find masks uncomfortable when you're exercising, then you may choose to exercise in places, either depending on the time of day or where you go, where you're much less likely to run into other people. But again, it's really about that distance and about the congregate setting. So I think you have to use your best judgment, but bringing it along and erring on the side of caution is always better.
We got a note from Lee, who wonders about masks and says OSHA does not currently define face coverings, such as the homemade masks, as PPE. I do not believe that any employer is required to provide face coverings because they're not PPE under OSHA. Interestingly, employers are most likely requiring people to wear face coverings. Could you address this, Tracy Dolan? If, as you know, as Vermonters return to work, and certainly this will help get us into this question too about elective procedures, as people return to work, if they're required to use facial coverings, who is going to provide those facial coverings? Because some Vermonters are still telling us they don't know where to get a mask. They don't know how to procure a mask. Beyond just the cost, sometimes it's having a mask is a problem.
Yeah, this is not an easy question to answer. Masks are going to become necessary for pretty much everyone living in Vermont. I would say probably everyone in the United States is going to be, and it is now, part of the way we need to live our lives, and that will continue to some extent. And so I don't know if it's going to be feasible for all employers to provide masks, for all services to provide masks for everyone coming in and out of their services or their businesses. And so I think it probably makes sense that Vermonters assume that they are going to have to take the responsibility to have their own masks. Certainly at hospitals, if you go into the hospital and you don't have one, hospitals are likely to provide you one. But in general, it should probably be assumed that you need your own mask. Now, some employers may elect to buy masks and provide them to their employees, but at this time, I don't know that we have it all ironed out about exactly who will provide masks. And certainly right now, the assumption is that Vermonters need to, for the most part, provide their own for day-to-day activities.
Well, on that question of elective procedures, you said the place, the healthcare setting, so whether it's a primary care physician's office or a hospital setting for an outpatient procedure, there is a requirement in the directive that came out today that patients and staff will need to wear masks. And there are other PPE requirements as well. Again, PPE, personal protective equipment. The Secretary of the Agency of Human Services, Mike Smith, said today in the state briefing, these healthcare facilities cannot use the state's supply of PPE. So who's going to pay for all this PPE and all of the masks that patients and staff are going to need to be wearing? And do you think we could see another, essentially a depletion of PPE and masks like we saw at the beginning of the pandemic if, as we open up, anybody who's getting a procedure is going to need to be wearing a mask?
So throughout the year in regular times, healthcare normally has their own PPE and they have their own vendors that they source that from. We anticipate it will continue in that fashion. We will have a higher burn rate. So the burn rate is the speed with which you go through the PPE. And you know, that will be a challenge, but the market is also picking up and meeting that demand. And so we anticipate right now, absent additional federal funds, which could be allocated out of the CARES Act, for example, to provide for some of the PPE, we do anticipate that healthcare will likely be providing their own PPE through their own vendors.
I mean, there is, as you said, going to be a higher burn rate. Wouldn't it be a significantly higher burn rate? Because typically, if you go in for a procedure, if you don't have symptoms of a communicable disease, you're not usually advised to wear a mask. But if everybody is having to wear them at all times, that burn rate also starts to put a significant cost burden on the providers, who are also then having to do more things. And this applies to employers as well, like significantly higher rates of cleaning and sanitizing in their facilities.
Yeah, there's no doubt that these conditions and the situation we're in is going to put a higher pressure and financial strain on everyone in terms of the PPE and in terms of other aspects as well. But there's no doubt about it. It's not a small increase. It's a significant increase in usage.
I mean, and this is not necessarily something for the health department, but it sounds like, you know, for some employers, that may be the prohibitive part of having people return to employment at a full level, is if you have to clean three times a day, you may not have the supplies or the money to be able to continue to have that kind of level of sanitizing supplies to be able to have your entire staff return to an office setting, for example.
You know, that could be an issue. Also, it's about what you choose to clean. And so if you look at some of the guidance, the focus on a lot of the cleaning is really on the high touch contact surfaces. Mm. And so that might be one way to be more efficient with the cleaning. So it's not necessarily that you have to mop down your floors three times a day. It might be that the focus on the more frequent cleaning are surfaces that people are more likely to touch, et cetera. So there may be ways to mitigate it, but certainly there's going to be a higher cleaning responsibility and burden and the PPE. And again, with other employers outside of healthcare, we're not sure how that's going to work with supplying PPE, because we also know that masks generally will be something that Vermonters need to have in their day-to-day lives. So that might become part and parcel of what an employer expects somebody to come in with. Again, not as sure on that part.
Hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about the new directive on elective outpatient procedures. The Scott administration guidance that came out today says healthcare providers can begin non-essential outpatient clinic visits, diagnostic imaging, and outpatient surgeries with a series of protocols in place. And so, you know, as was stated in the press conference today, something like a hip surgery where you're expected to be inpatient for after the procedure, that is not yet allowed, but a mammogram might be allowed. And so we've gotten some questions from people on that. And one came from Brennan, who wants to know, does this open up standard dentistry? And we got a lot of questions from dentists last week as well on when might they be able to provide kinds of routine exams. So does this apply to dentistry, Tracy Dolan?
So we've been meeting here at the health department weekly with healthcare leadership and also with other associated leadership like the Dental Society. And last week they submitted a proposal for their rollout as they move through the phases toward restart. And so I know that right now we're allowing for emergency dentistry, and I know they have a proposal in to begin to roll it out. They're trying to ramp up with their PPE, thinking about spacing within their offices. So I don't know that it's applicable right now. I believe that proposal is in. I'm not seeing it in the executive order, but I do know that dentistry is ready to come online very soon with some procedures.
We also got a question from Mag, who says, what if someone does outpatient medical services at Dartmouth-Hitchcock, like a mammogram, but lives in Vermont. Do they need to quarantine for 14 days upon return? So here's where two different directives may be clashing, but maybe there's some clarity. Because if you leave the state of Vermont, you're supposed to, when you return, quarantine for 14 days. But there are questions. There are a lot of people who live in border communities who may feel that that border is a little bit more fluid or porous than the border that might that we're sort of talking about with a 14-day quarantine. And then as these elective procedures are opening up, if you're someone who receives medical care in a different state from where you live, how should you try to keep those two things in mind? Deputy Commissioner?
Sure. I know there are some exceptions to the quarantine rule if you're in Vermont and you go across the border for particular purposes or for a particular amount of time. I don't know for sure what happens if you go over across the border for a procedure. And so I'll probably have to check into that and get back to you, Jane.
And why does this not apply to inpatient procedures yet? Is it just a matter of the volume of PPE that would be necessary, or why are we not allowing yet elective inpatient?
I think it's about risk. And so we're trying to roll out, as Patsy mentioned earlier, we really want to do pretty extensive health surveillance as we reopen, and we're doing it in these slow paces. And I know it's very frustrating and it's very difficult financially for healthcare, but we're going step by step. So the first step being outpatient, and then let's monitor and see what we've got for transmission or an uptick in cases, and then moving into inpatient. And so there are some increased risks, obviously, with hospital stay. Some of that's about PPE. Some of that's about more invasive procedures. And so we are moving carefully as we go.
Let's go to Leona, who's with us from Bennington. Hi, Leona.
Hi. I have a thought. I'm a person who's recovered pretty much from amnesia. And my biggest fear is if I were to receive the call that said you have been exposed and who have you seen in the last 2 weeks, I would be terrified that I would not be able to remember everybody. So I'm thinking, could we talk to people about that? I know there's other people who have memory challenges, not just me, about thinking ahead about ways to start paying attention to that. And I know that when we first start coming out, we're not going to be seeing many people, but it will probably gradually escalate the number of people that we'll see. And 2 weeks is a long time to remember everybody.
Leona, good question. And so, you know, Leona may be in a slightly different situation than many people in that she's recovering from amnesia. But certainly even for people who don't have memory issues, remembering everybody you've been in contact with for a significant amount of time is really difficult. So, Patsy Kelso, how would you advise someone like Leona, you know, make a list, keep track of things, do anything differently as you go about your daily life, whether you have memory issues or not, but specifically if you do have some memory issues?
Yeah, it's a great idea to just start sort of keeping track, whether it's a daily calendar of places you go or things you do, or more of a list of who you know that you've interacted with. Anything like that can be really helpful if you do end up being a case and the health department needs to find out who you've been in contact with while you were infectious. That could be super helpful.
Well, yeah, Leona, thanks for your concern and interesting question. Jennifer is with us from Morrisville. Jennifer, hi, go right ahead.
Hi. I am curious about the fact that 30% of the tests, I was just swabbed up the nose, and I heard that 30% of the time there'll be a false negative. So how do we work with people who were given a false negative, yet they're out and they're like, well, I've been tested, I don't have the coronavirus, and are continuing to be distancing, but they still might actually have this virus and be walking around with it. Seems like a very difficult situation to be in a false sense of safety.
Yeah, Jennifer, thanks. Tracy Dolan, I mean, this is a significant question. It keeps coming back, and we still don't have, you know, a testing protocol where everybody is able to trust that if there's a negative, you know, if the test is negative, that it actually means you don't have COVID-19.
Sure. And again, I'll refer back to what Patsy said earlier. We did check in with our lab. The FDA wasn't able to do the level of clinical rigor on the tests that they released, in part because we had to move quickly toward testing. However, what we do have indicates that this test is accurate 95% of the time. And so we don't anticipate that there are a lot of false negatives. If somebody appears to have COVID-19 and their physician still thinks, even despite the test, that they should act in accordance with that, the physician will recommend isolation. And certainly if anyone is ill, they should be staying home. But for the most part, we would still recommend, of course, anyone out wearing masks and social distancing. But we're relatively confident in the tests as much as we can be now. And so I think that's the best answer I can give there.
Just a minute left, but I want to highlight one thing that came up again in today's press briefing. State officials say there's been a significant decrease in reports of child abuse, but that doesn't mean there's been a significant decrease in child abuse. It may be because children have become, as AHS Secretary Smith put it, less visible to child care providers, school providers, medical providers, and mandated reporters may just not be seeing the signs of concerns that they normally would. That's really disturbing. Is there any way that people should be thinking about how to help and ways that the health department is thinking about this as a public health issue?
Schools are one of the safest places for a lot of kids who are at risk. And so it's not surprising that when they're not in school, they're less safe, in part because there are more eyes on them at school as well. And I don't know that the health department has any unique initiatives around this, except to say that, you know, we encourage parents and anyone to do things during their day to relieve stress. And that is the important part about getting outside, exercising, taking a break. It's never too late to do nothing when you're frustrated with your child. It's never too late to simply just walk away and take a breath and come back. Your patients will be tested with kids, and use all of the techniques that you can because, you know, people are cooped up together. And so, you know, do your best to walk away and take a breath and get outside and do something that is less stress-inducing when the stress builds up.
That's Tracy Dolan, Deputy Commissioner for the Vermont Department of Health. And we've also been talking with Patsy Kelso, State Epidemiologist. Thanks very much to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.